On January 26, 2011, 27-year-old Ellen Greenberg left work early when a snowstorm hit Philadelphia. She stopped for gas on her way home, then spent the afternoon grading papers in the apartment she shared with her fiancé, Sam. That evening, Sam called 911 to report that he had found Ellen in the kitchen with a knife in her chest. She had been stabbed 20 times, including multiple wounds to the back of her head and neck. At first, the medical examiner ruled her death a homicide, but weeks later, the ruling was changed to a suicide, shocking many. Ellen's parents have spent more than a decade fighting that decision, convinced their daughter didn't take her own life, and that the truth of what happened to her is still being covered up. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. All right, so as you can see from the title and from that intro, we're covering Ellen Greenberg. I have to say that this is probably the most requested case I've ever received since we started Detective Perspective. Almost 100 requests, if not more. And I do think part of it is because of the recent docuseries talking about this whole incident. And I watched it. I understand why. I felt like the documentary was done well, but to me, it left me almost as confused as I was when I started it. You know, there wasn't a lot of answers in there, which I guess is a good thing. They kind of kept it objective, left you in the middle, kind of to develop your own thoughts and opinions. But I feel like that series, with the attention that it got, really spiked this case again and rejuvenated, although there is a huge backing for this case already. So I started looking into this case, we researched it, and I have done a ton of work on this case. In fact, just to be completely transparent with you guys, this episode will be coming out on Monday. I'm recording it on Saturday. I usually record on the Thursday before it comes out, but I tried to do that. And after reading it and watching different podcasts and YouTube videos and docuseries and going over this new 32, 33 page release that just came out, I found myself at different points during the day and the days that followed feeling different about the case. There are points where you feel like one theory could be supported by some of the evidence, and then there's other pieces of evidence that discredit it. And then you go the next day and you feel a different way about it. And there was a small window there where I was talking to my team, wondering if I should even cover this. Not because I was afraid of it, not because I've ever shied away from giving my opinion, but I didn't want to do what the docuseries did for me. And I'm not discrediting the docuseries. I thought it was done well, but I wanted to add value to this case. And I didn't want to cover it and have you guys feeling or being just as confused when you started, or feeling a certain way about it and feeling that I've added no value. So after talking about it and sleeping on it multiple nights, I revisited everything. I went over everything that I had already talked about in my head, that I had researched, that I had watched. I wrote some more notes. I sat there with it. And then I started reaching out to experts in the field, because what I found was it wasn't my detective experience that was confusing me here. I feel like the process of this investigation, there were flaws in it, and we're going to talk about that. That is something I can speak to. But the real crux of this case goes back to the autopsy report and the pathology. That's where this is really at. And so many experts have weighed in on this case. and they don't all agree. But for me to sit here and talk about pathology and to talk about the autopsy report and pick it apart and give my opinion on it, I'm more than entitled to do that. Many have already. But what I really wanted to do was talk to people in the field who have done hundreds, if not thousands, of these cases and could maybe share some more insight for me. So as I was doing my research, I had seen a couple pathologists that came out with their findings and came out with their opinions. And there's been some respected leaders in the field. Just a few names that came up. We had Dr. Cyril Wecht back in 2012. We had Dr. Henry Lee. I also stumbled on an interview with the medical examiner that I was familiar with, Priya Banerjee, who used to be the Rhode Island medical examiner. Now she's retired. She's still doing consultation work. She's still doing expert testimony. And she's making her rounds with the different podcasts and YouTube channels. And I saw her thoughts on this case. So I reached out to her and we had a very good conversation. And during that conversation, she pointed out some things to me that as a detective, I didn't think about or I didn't understand because I'm not a doctor and this is not something that I'm familiar with. And I have to tell you, after speaking with her, I felt better about my opinion on this case and the way that I was leaning as far as what I think happened here. And I'm going to share that with you, no doubt about it. I'm going to talk about it, and I think I feel confident enough to speak on it after speaking with her. However, we're going to do something different here with this episode, because instead of it being one episode, it's going to be our first multi-part series. Why? There's just no way I can cover this in 45 minutes to an hour. I could just do a 3-hour episode. This episode tonight will be longer. I don't want to do that. I want to break it into parts. And I'm interested to hear your feedback after doing this. Maybe you guys like it this way. Maybe you don't. Maybe this is something we do again. Maybe this is a one-off. But the way I'm going to break this down is instead of giving my opinions heavily throughout the episode and then my perspective at the end, I'm going to try to keep it as fact-based as possible. Because although this is a popular case, not everyone who's listening or watching right now has heard of it extensively, has done the research. So I want to start with a lot of the exposition and go through the case based on what we do know. And then what I plan on doing in part two is getting more into the case specifics, because there's still going to be more. And then I'm actually going to bring Dr. Banerjee in for an interview in person in my studio that I just built. And this will be my first interview that I've ever done in this studio. And the reason I'm doing that is because I want her to share her professional opinion directly with all of you guys. Because like I said, I knew from the initial thought, hearing about this case, 20 stab wounds, my first thought, no way this woman killed herself. There's just no way. Not physically possible. How did she stab herself in the neck and then in the chest? And then you start to dive into some of the details and some of her history and you think, oh, is there a world where she could have killed herself? Although that's a very unusual set of circumstances, is it possible? And then you start to go back and you start to look at the pathologists and the experts and why they think it's not possible. And then there's biomechanical engineers who think it is. And you just go back and forth. But it wasn't until I spoke to Dr. Banerjee that I was like, okay, I get it. I get it now. I know what I believe, and I want to share that with my audience. So that's how I'm planning on breaking down the series. And then at the end of the series, in the last part, whether it's two parts or three parts, that's when I'll give my perspective. That's when I'll give my opinion. I don't want to influence anybody who hasn't already come to their own conclusions. And so we're going to go through it all. I will be weighing in as we go throughout the episode. But at the end of all of it, we'll talk about it. I'll let you guys know where I stand, and we'll go from there. So I appreciate it. I know that was a long intro right there, but I wanted to really disclose everything that I plan on doing so you guys have some insight going into it, so you don't expect a conclusion tonight. But yeah, we have a lot to cover. As I always say, I don't want to waste any more time. Let's dive into this week's case. Ellen Ray Greenberg was born on June 23rd, 1983, to parents Josh and Sandy Greenberg. She was their only child and the center of their world. When Ellen was about 12 years old, the family moved to Pennsylvania, where she was known for being bubbly, positive, and full of life. After high school, Ellen went to Temple University, where she studied education. She loved working with kids and dreamed of becoming a teacher. and once she earned her degree, she began teaching first grade in the Philadelphia school district. In 2007, Ellen started dating Samuel Goldberg. The two fell in love, and by the summer of 2010, they were engaged. They settled into an apartment together on the sixth floor of the Venice Lofts, a luxury complex in a secure area with a gate, a guard on duty, and cameras. By mid-January 2011, Ellen and Sam had picked their wedding date, August 2011, and they sent out their save the dates. Everyone said that Ellen was thrilled about the upcoming wedding. Tragically, she would never get to walk down the aisle. On January 26, 2011, Philadelphia was hit by a heavy snowstorm. Classes were dismissed early, and Ellen headed home. She stopped to fill her gas tank and arrived back at the apartment just after 1:30 p.m. Sam came home about 20 minutes later. He worked remotely that afternoon, and Ellen sat nearby entering grades for her students. It seemed like an ordinary snow day. But then, at 6:33 p.m., Sam dialed 911. He told the operator that he had just found Ellen in the kitchen with a knife in her chest. Now, I have the 911 call, and I'm going to play it for you now, because if you haven't heard it, you need to.
Help! I need a murder. I just walked to my apartment. My fiance is on the floor with blood everywhere.
What is the address?
4601 Flat Rock Road. Please come. Help! Now!
4601
Flat Rock Road.
Is this a house or apartment?
Oh, no. Oh, no. It's an apartment. Please hurry,
where
please.
Where is she bleeding from?
I don't know. I can't tell.
So you have to calm yourself down in order to get you some help.
I'm sorry. I don't know. I'm looking at her right now. I can't see anything. There's nothing broken. She's bleeding. Ellie!
You don't know where she's bleeding from? Can't
Ellie,
see where the blood's coming from?
I think she hit her head. But it's up everywhere.
Okay, so it's everywhere. Think she might have fallen? Do you know what happened?
She may have slipped. There's blood on the table. Her face is a little purple.
Okay, hold on for rescue for her. Stay on the phone.
I went downstairs to go work out. I came back up. The door was latched. My fiance's inside. She wasn't answering, so after about a half hour, I decided to break it down. I see her now just on the floor with blood. She's not responding.
Okay, is she breathing? Look at her chest. I need you to calm down, and I need you to look at her chest. It's really.
I don't think she is.
Listen to me. Someone's on the way. Look at her chest. Is she flat on her back?
She's on her back.
Look at her chest and tell me if it's going up and down, up and down.
I don't see her moving.
Okay, do you know how to do CPR?
I don't.
Okay, I can tell you what to do, okay, until they get there. I want you to keep her flat.
Oh, God.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, okay.
Are you willing to do CPR with me over the phone until they get there?
I have to, right?
Okay, so get her flat on her back, bare her chest, okay? You want to rip her shirt off, okay? She needs to kneel down by her side.
Oh, my God. Allie, please.
Listen, you can't freak out, sir, because you
okay, I'm trying not to, Her shirt won't come off, it's a zipper.
Rip
oh, my
off.
God, she stabbed herself.
Where?
She fell in a knife. Oh, no. Her knife's sticking out.
Her what?
There's a knife sticking out of her heart.
Oh, she stabbed herself?
I guess so. I don't know where she fell on it. I don't know.
Okay, well, don't touch it.
Okay, I'm just let her down here now. I mean, what do I do?
No, I mean, you can't. If the knife is in her chest, it's going to be kind of hard for you to do CPR at this time.
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Police, which operator?
277.
Is someone coming here?
Yes, they are. You said 4601 Flat Rock, right?
Yes.
Okay, someone's on the way. And the knife is still inside?
Wait, your what?
The knife is still inside of her?
Yes, I didn't take it out.
Was it her chest or what area?
It's in her chest. It looks like it's right in her heart.
Okay, someone's on the way out there. Okay, just get
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Okay, how old is she?
She's 27.
27. And there's no sign of life at all?
No, please don't be. What?
Bend her under her arm and tell me she responds to pain.
She's. Ellie! She's not. Her hands are still warm. I don't know what that means, but there's blood everywhere. I mean.
I know, but you can't, and the knife is still inside of her. How far? Can you see how far it went in?
It looks pretty deep.
Okay.
It looks three, and it's a long knife.
Don't touch anything.
Yeah, don't touch anything, okay?
I'm not touching anything. I can't believe this, though.
No, wait, it was just you there with her?
We're the only ones here.
And she ran in the door, you said, latched it shut?
No, I went downstairs to work out, and when I came back up, the door was latched.
Oh.
Like, it was locked from the inside, and I'm yelling, and I was yelling.
Was the house broken into?
No.
So there's no sign of a break-in?
No sign of a break-in at all. I mean, there will be when you get here, because I had to break the latch, but to get in.
All right, so there's the 911 call from Sam, Ellen's fiance, all 4 minutes and 9 seconds of it. And people have really broke this down, and they've read between the lines, and they've analyzed it and given their opinions. I'm no voice analysis expert. I've talked about these 911 calls before. I like to hear what they have to say and how they say it, but I don't put a lot of stock into the analysis because everyone reacts to trauma differently. So depending on how you want to view this, I do think confirmation bias can come into a lot of it. I will point out a few things. I thought it was interesting that in the very beginning of the call and then at the end, he wanted to point out that he had left the apartment and that the door was locked. Some could say that's because he's just trying to give them context, but he wasn't really even asked at first where he was or what had happened or was he gone or was he there. But it felt like he wanted to get that out. Now, that could just be a natural instinct. There may be nothing malicious about it, but I thought that was interesting. And the other thing was the fact that he didn't notice anything out of the ordinary regarding the knife sticking out of her chest. Apparently, it was under her shirt, but still, you would expect to see the handle of that knife protruding from her heart, and it would be very obvious that something there didn't look normal. And yet, he completely missed that. Now, that could be because he's got tunnel vision on her face, or it's because he's trying to act surprised, trying to at least give the impression that he doesn't know what transpired. I know there are people out there who have covered this case and inferred that may be what transpired here. And then people talk a lot about his demeanor, right? He's kind of calm, kind of a jerk at certain points where he's like, oh, I guess I have to, right? When they're asking if he's willing to do CPR. If I had a baseline for how Sam reacted in similar situations when under this type of stress, then I could give you a better assessment of whether this is normal or not, because the baseline would be based on Sam, not me, not you, not anybody else. Everybody is different. The same thing happens in an interrogation room. I know there are experts out there that can use science and psychology and their years of experience to deduce something from behavior, but it's always better when you have a foundation to work off of. So when I'm in that interrogation room, I'm learning about this person in real time. I'm making notes about their specific behaviors, both verbal and nonverbal cues. And then I'm using that as my baseline to develop out of the ordinary behavior as the interview or interrogation moves forward. So not having that type of data to go back and reference when analyzing Sam's 911 call, it hurts. It hurts the investigatory process in that sense where you can make some educated guesses on what his behavior and his tone of voice may infer, but it's not a science. It's not a science, and it would be speculative at best. So that's my interpretation of it. I, again, don't put a lot into it. If he's guilty of something here, you can listen to that and say, yep, makes sense. You could tell guilty as sin. And if he's innocent, then you could look at it and go, this is a guy who just walked in on his fiance, stabbed multiple times, bleeding everywhere, and he's just in shock at this moment. So again, depending on how you want to look at it, I do think you can listen to that audio recording and take what you want out of it. But there were a couple of things that he had said that raised an eyebrow. I'll say that. And so after this phone call takes place, he immediately calls his parents, who then notify Ellen's parents. And then at 6:35 p.m., 2 minutes after the 911 call, first responders arrive and found Ellen in the kitchen, positioned in the corner between the sink and the stove. According to court documents, her shoulders were resting against the lower half of the kitchen cabinets. And as far as her positioning, she was slumped downward, sitting on her butt and lower back. Her legs were stretched straight out in front of her, and both arms rested alongside her body. Just to note, officers did document what appeared to be a small cluster of long, dark hairs positioned between her legs. In her left hand, Ellen held a white hand towel that appeared clean. Her right hand was loosely clenched, and her glasses lay on the floor nearby. A 10-inch serrated knife was lodged in the left side of her chest through her clothing. Now, if we go back to the 911 call and we talk about how Sam found and described the knife, this could also raise an eyebrow for you, because if we go back to that, he didn't notice it at first. And when you listen to the recording, you may have interpreted as, oh, maybe the knife was underneath her shirt and it was just poking the shirt out a little bit. Maybe he missed that. But from the description here, you would have clearly seen the handle sticking out of her chest. He also made a comment about it being a large knife, about being a long knife, I believe he said exactly. And how do you know that instantly? If you can only see the handle, I believe this knife was from a knife block. There's other knives of different sizes in there. Did he immediately recognize what the knife was? Was this a Freudian slip? Was it a guess just based on what he saw? I don't know. I'm pointing it out to you simply to put the thought in your brain and we can all ponder it together. But that was something that I found interesting, considering he didn't even know the knife was there, allegedly, and now he's able to tell you that it's a long knife, even though half of it is plunged into her chest. When first responders examined Ellen's body more closely, they didn't see any clear signs of defense wounds. There were multiple injuries clustered near the knife, but they described them as, quote, superficial. First responders then looked over the scene and noted that the blood was confined to the area where Ellen was found. It hadn't been smeared or transferred around the room, and there were no indications of a struggle. Now, it is worth noting that there was a strainer of fruit on the counter, and the oranges and blueberries inside the strainer looked freshly prepared, as if Ellen had been in the middle of making maybe a fruit salad or something. You also had two clean knives in the sink, and both appeared to be free of blood. So when we think about this fruit, it could be a red herring. It could be just trivial. But when you think about it, and you're going to get to a point where law enforcement is telling you that this is a suicide, then you also have to acknowledge that what had happened here was Ellen's in the middle of making some type of snack or fruit salad or whatever you have. And in the middle of that, and while she's cutting up these oranges and blueberries, she decides to stab herself 20 times, one of them directly into her heart. That's the hang up here for many of you. And I get it. I get it. That's a lot to take in. She's in the middle of the day. Her fiance's downstairs using the gym. And she's in the apartment by herself making some type of meal. And in the middle of it, for no reason, nothing to indicate that something happened, she brutally stabs herself in the back of the neck, gashes her head, and then eventually stabs herself in the chest in the middle of making this meal. There are outliers in true crime, but this is a big hangup for a lot of the experts out there, the pathologists. This is not the normal behavior you see associated with a suicide. And some of these experts have done thousands of cases. And as they admit, there are some unusual circumstances. This is not something you often see. And we haven't even gotten to the injuries yet. I'm just talking about the circumstances surrounding where she was found. This doesn't look like someone who was getting ready to end their life. They weren't in their bedroom. They didn't leave a suicide note. This looks like someone who was in the middle of making food. Not something you often see. And I haven't done 100,000 suicides, but this is my first experience with a situation where you walk into a crime scene and someone before killing themselves is in the middle of making a fruit salad. Just not something you would expect to see. And there also was a knife block on the counter as well, and it had been tipped over on its side, but there was no visible blood on the knife block or any of the other knives in the knife block. Now, the knife that was found in Ellen's chest was consistent with the knives in the sink and the block. All appeared to be part of the same set. So this goes back to Sam, where he knows these knives. And my knife block at home, and you guys may disagree, please weigh in down in the comments. You have different sizes. You have your chef's knife, you have your bread knife, you have your paring knife. You have a filer usually that can sharpen the knives, but you can't really tell the size when they're in the block. They all have similar length handles. There's also a lot of steak knives too in my set. So if you put those knives in front of me, I wouldn't be able to tell you which knife is which. Yes, the paring knife and some of the shorter knives have a little bit smaller of a handle. The bread knife is really the only one that stands out to me. But a lot of the knives look similar, especially when they're in the block. So in that moment, when you're seeing just a handle in your fiance's chest, how are you able to determine that quickly that it's a long knife and not one of the shorter knives? Some of you may disagree with me in the comments. I'm just putting it out there so we can all discuss it. But what we can all agree on, because nobody's disputing it, is that the knife that caused all of these injuries was a knife from inside that apartment. So if you're thinking suicide, it would support it. If you're thinking homicide, if it were Sam, it would support that as well. If you're thinking outside intruder that we haven't identified yet, that gets a little sticky, because then you have to assume that whoever it was went into this apartment and didn't have the weapon with them. So the intentionality may not have been there at first, and then it escalated. So that's something you have to consider, because if we're talking about a person where this is a premeditated murder, they go in there, they kill her, they get out, more than likely they're going to bring their own weapon. The fact that they would use a knife from the knife block, running the risk of leaving their DNA on that knife block, which shouldn't be there because they're not a resident of that apartment, that's a slippery slope, and I don't think that's likely. So we're going to talk about it. We're going to consider it, but these are the circumstances that kind of dispel the potential theory that this was just a random act of violence by someone we haven't figured out who they are yet. According to court documents, detectives were called to the scene. They searched the apartment and saw no signs of struggle or forced entry aside from the front door, which Sam had said he had broken down to get inside. The only other exit was the rear sliding door that led to the sixth floor patio. Now, it's important to note here that snow covered the patio surface. Remember, there's a snowstorm that day, and it was completely undisturbed. There were no tracks or footprints. So that's extremely important, again, when we're talking about all theories at this point and the possibility that someone had entered the apartment unlawfully, whether it was through the front door, knocking on the door and presenting themselves as a friendly, getting inside. That's still possible. But to think that someone could have scaled the side of the building and entered through the balcony door, not likely, not likely, unless they can float, because they would have left some type of footprint either entering the apartment or exiting through that same balcony door. No signs of it. So in this instance, the snow is our friend, because it allows us to see if anyone had been out on that patio before this incident took place. Not the case. I also want to mention that there was no suicide note found either. And this is a big thing for a lot of the experts. I was looking at Dr. Cyril Weck's report from 2012. He had noted that usually with a case like this, especially if this person's been thinking about it, building up to it, they would leave a note explaining to their family why they were doing this. We might not agree with their opinions, but at least give us some insight as to why they felt like this was the only way out. This is the only way to stop whatever they were feeling. Again, no note. So if we're to believe that this was a suicide, 1 minute she was fine, the next minute she's stabbing herself. Is it possible? At this point, yeah, sure, it's possible. Does it seem likely? Absolutely not. However, despite all of this, the detectives at the scene immediately theorized that Ellen's death was a suicide. Assistant medical examiner Dr. Marlon Osborne was called to the apartment. Detectives immediately told them about their theory. They also relayed Sam's statement about finding the door locked from the inside and discovering Ellen on the floor. And at first glance, Dr. Osborne agreed that the wounds appeared to be superficial and the scene was treated as a suicide, not a homicide. Huge mistake, and this is something I can speak on. I don't understand it. Yes, you may have come to a conclusion that potentially it was a suicide, but how many cases have detectives or patrolmen walked into and thought something at first and then found out it was something else? This is not rocket science, guys. It's much easier to initially treat the scene as a homicide, which is going to involve all hands on deck, a more thorough crime scene analysis, a higher value on collection of evidence and preservation to make sure if someone has to be charged, they're capable of doing so. It's just more involved, right? It's going to be a lot more intense. It's much easier to do that and then decide later, oh, you know what? This is a suicide. We don't need all of it. Yeah, it took a couple extra man hours, a little bit more resources, but it's better to be safe than sorry. However, when you treat it as a suicide and then realize, oh no, this was a homicide, well, you can't go back and recreate the scene. You're already left. It's already contaminated. Anything you find now, there's a chain of custody issue. It gives an opportunity for anybody who might be involved to clean up the scene after you leave. So you're screwed. you're screwed and you can't go back and do your job. So this was a mistake. This should not have happened. Again, I told you at the beginning, I'm going to bring in a pathologist to talk about what I think is the most important thing in the case. However, this is also critical as well. And it's going to come more into play when I get further into the story. But even at this point, this is not what you do. If there's any question at all, and there should be, you treat it as a homicide and you work backwards if you need to. So as I just kind of alluded to, because it wasn't treated as a homicide, the apartment was never processed as a crime scene. And according to Penn Live, only a, quote, limited number of crime scene photos were taken, and the only items collected for evidence were the medications that belonged to Ellen and her journal. The detectives left behind her phone and both of her laptops. Again, huge mistake that you have digital data on there that could indicate maybe it's a suicide or maybe it's something else. Maybe there's a motive there. But by leaving it behind, you allow for the possibility of tampering and contamination. Huge mistake. I would like to think that if they could go over and do it again, they would have taken that stuff, because even if there wasn't nothing on there, at least they could say that. But they didn't, and you can't go back now. Sam was also taken to the station for an interview that night, and according to the medical examiner's report released as I was putting this whole episode together, Sam told detectives that he had got home just before 2 p.m., and Ellen was already there. He did say that she was upset about her job and mentioned wanting to quit. He further explained that Ellen had been stressed about work for a couple of weeks leading up to that day. Sam said he offered her some words of encouragement, then he left the apartment around 4:45 p.m. to use the building's gym. When he left, Ellen was grading papers. 35 minutes later, he returned to the apartment, but the latch on the door was engaged, so he couldn't get inside. Sam called and texted Ellen to let him in, but he got no response. He then went down to the lobby to speak with the building's concierge to see if maintenance could help him open the door. They didn't have a way to open the latch from the outside, so he went back upstairs and tried calling her again, but still, there was no answer. Sam told detectives that he then forced his way inside, and that's when he saw Ellen on the kitchen floor, and he immediately called 911. After Sam was done giving his statement, he was free to go, and the apartment was released back to him without being forensically searched by crime scene technicians. Obviously, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, big mistake. Meanwhile, Ellen's body had been transported for autopsy. Notably, the knife wasn't bagged at the scene. It remained in Ellen's body until Dr. Osborne removed it during the autopsy the following day. The knife and Ellen's clothing were collected as evidence and sent off for testing. And it's worth noting that when those results came back, they both had Ellen's DNA on them, but no one else's. We're just scratching the surface. We have a lot more to cover. We're going to talk about it right after the break. You ever go through something tough, maybe a breakup, a burnout, or even just that creeping anxiety that doesn't let you sleep at night and you're laying there thinking, I wish I had someone I can talk to who actually gets it. I've definitely been there, and I have seen how powerful therapy can be, not only for me, but for my friends, for my family, and for the people that are close to me who were really struggling and just needed help. But let's be honest, getting access to the right therapist, it can be a nightmare. You call around and people aren't taking new clients, they're not in your network, or it costs a fortune. That's where Rula comes in. Rula is changing the game. They make high-quality mental health care accessible and affordable. Most people pay only $15 a session, and they take most major insurance. You answer a few quick questions, and you're matched with a licensed professional who meets your preferences, and you can be talking to someone as soon as the next day. And by the way, with Rula, they have over 15,000 therapists and psychiatrists in their network. And Rula doesn't just leave you hanging after that. They actually stay with you, checking in on your progress and making sure you're getting what you need out of therapy. Whether it's a therapist or even a psychiatrist to help with medication management, Rula's got you covered. So if you've been thinking about therapy, or even if this is the first time you're considering it, this is your sign. Thousands of people have already trusted Rula to support them on their journey toward improved mental health and overall well-being. So head over to Rula.com/detective to get started today. After you sign up, they're going to ask you where you heard about them. I'd really appreciate it if you support this show and tell them that I sent you. Once again, that's Rula.com/detective and take the first step towards better mental health today. You deserve quality care from someone who cares. Okay, we're back. And the next morning, on January 27th, before Ellen's autopsy, detectives spoke with her parents and shared their theory that Ellen had taken her own life. Understandably, the Greenbergs told detectives they were struggling to understand what had happened. According to court documents, they said Ellen had never attempted suicide or expressed any suicidal ideations, and her death came as a complete surprise to them. Sandy said she last spoke to Ellen at 7 a.m. on the 26th while they were both on their way to work. The conversation was completely normal, and Ellen didn't say or do anything that suggested something might be wrong. Detectives then asked about Ellen's mental health leading up to her death, and her parents explained that in the weeks before and after the save the dates were sent out, Ellen had become increasingly stressed about work and had started talking about leaving teaching altogether. They noticed that she had grown more withdrawn and less independent, often relying on Sam to make decisions she used to make herself. They said she seemed less happy overall, a sharp contrast from her normal outgoing, upbeat, and cheerful personality. The Greenbergs told detectives that they had encouraged Ellen to see a psychiatrist because of her growing anxiety, and she agreed to do so. And she met with the psychiatrist three times between January 12th and January 19th, 2011. The psychiatrist prescribed her Klonopin and Ambien to help her with the anxiety and sleep. After starting the medication, Ellen told both her psychiatrist and her parents that the medicine seemed to be helping. She texted her mom, quote, "Klonopin helped. Thank God." Ellen had scheduled another psychiatric appointment for January 27th, but obviously she never made it. Before the Greenbergs left the interview, they were asked what they thought about Sam, and they said they had no reservations about the relationship and hadn't heard about any abuse. And that was interesting to me, because if detectives were so locked in on the suicide theory, maybe you're just throwing this question out there to check all your boxes, but if there's nothing surrounding any speculation about Sam or his possible involvement, why are we asking about him? Hasn't he gone through enough? He just walked in on his fiance's suicide. Again, in their minds, this may have just been a throwaway question, but as an interviewer and an interrogator myself, I usually try to impede on the victims and their families' lives as little as possible and not cause any type of dissension. So if this is so clear-cut that it's a suicide, why are we asking about the only other person who, at least at this point, could potentially be involved? I just found it interesting. Was this interviewer who was talking to the family just an outlier and maybe had their own suspicions and were curious and was just making sure that there was nothing there? Potentially. But I find it a little bit outside the realm of the questioning that they had been asked about, which was Ellen's mental health. And this seemed like an outlier. And I wish I could ask this interviewer why. Why at the time they felt the need to ask about Sam if there was no speculation about his potential involvement. Detectives also interviewed Ellen's psychiatrist that morning as well. And according to court documents, she told detectives that Ellen first came to her on January 12th, and she said she had been dealing with severe anxiety for about 2 months due to work. The psychiatrist explained that when she asked about Sam, Ellen had nothing but good things to say. She even noted that Ellen smiled when she spoke about him. When asked directly about abuse, Ellen denied any verbal or physical confrontations. She also denied ever having suicidal thoughts. By Ellen's third appointment on January 19th, the psychiatrist said she was doing, quote, way better. They were working on a treatment plan, and as I just mentioned earlier, they also had an appointment scheduled for January 27th. After these interviews, Ellen's autopsy took place. According to the autopsy report, Dr. Marlon Osborne found 20 wounds, many of which were not superficial as originally believed. There were 8 stab wounds to Ellen's chest, including the wound that still contained the 10-inch knife. Dr. Osborne found the knife had been driven 4 inches into her chest. The remaining 7 chest wounds ranged in depth from 0.2 centimeters to 1.5 inches. There was a single wound to Ellen's abdomen that was just over 2 inches deep, and on the right side of her scalp, Dr. Osborne found an incised wound as well. Now, the incised wound, the best way I could describe it is if you get hit with like a sharp object, the corner of something, it can cause like a split, like a gash, a clean gash on your head. I'm sure if any of you have children or maybe yourself, you walk into something, the corner of something sharp, it can split you right open. That's the best way I can describe it. The remaining 10 wounds were located on the back of Ellen's neck. They varied in depth between 0.2 centimeters and 3 inches deep. Now, two of these neck wounds stood out to Dr. Osborne. One of them was the 3-inch wound at the base of her skull, and it impacted her cerebellum, which is the part of the brain that controls coordination, balance, and movement. Another wound measured 2¾ inches and extended between Ellen's 2nd and 3rd vertebrae, moving, quote, down over the spinal cord. And while there was no obvious damage to the spinal cord itself, Dr. Osborne noted that the injury would have been enough to incapacitate Ellen due to both pain and physiological response. This wound alone led Dr. Osborne to conclude that Ellen had been murdered. So he removed and preserved this section of her spinal column that contained the injury, now because he considered it a valuable piece of evidence. Dr. Osborne also documented 11 bruises and various stages of healing on Ellen's wrists, right arm, abdomen, and right leg. He did not investigate the bruises beyond noting them on the report. In addition, toxicology testing showed subtherapeutic levels of Klonopin and Ambien in Ellen's system, which, as you know, were both prescribed medications. After completing the autopsy, Dr. Osborne officially ruled Ellen's death a homicide. And that's it. That's it right there, right? That's where everyone out there who is crying out for a more thorough investigation, is asking federal investigators to get involved with this case, is asking the U.S. attorney, I believe his name's Metcalf, to get involved. This right here is a big part of that. The initial investigation conducted by the original pathologist ruled that Ellen had been killed. This isn't speculation. This isn't conjecture. This is the actual doctor who had Ellen's body in front of him. He determined, based on the injuries that he observed with his own eyes, that she had been killed by someone else. That's compelling. I don't care who you are. I don't care what side of the aisle you fall on in this case. This is why a large part of the population believes that Ellen Greenberg was killed and that she did not kill herself. And I completely understand where you're coming from, because I agree with you. Other than a couple detectives who went to the crime scene and pretty much ruled right away that it was a suicide, the real boots on the ground here, the doctor, came out and said it publicly. This young woman was killed. And yeah, so that's why everyone's in an uproar over this case, because initially, which doesn't often happen, this was classified as a homicide by the ME. And usually it's the other way around, where it's ruled an accidental death or suicide, and we're screaming, no, this was a homicide. Polar opposite here. And that's another reason that there's such a big outcry and there's so much investment from the public about this case, because this isn't where this story ends. We're really, I know I say this in all these cases, but we're just getting started, which is, again, another reason why I have to spend so much time on it in not only this episode, but in future episodes, because there's no way we can cover it all. So yes, I don't want to skate over this. This case was officially ruled a homicide by the ME's office based on her injuries. He ruled that based on what happened to her neck, there was no way that she would have been able to physically stab herself after injuring her spinal cord. So basically, to dumb it down for me and everybody else who may need it, essentially what Dr. Osborne is saying is, hey, we know that the last stab wound was into her chest. That's where the knife was found. We believe that knife caused all the other injuries. There's no way that she would have been able to injure her spinal cord and then still physically stab herself in the chest. Sounds pretty simple to me, right? Not a lot of interpretation needed there. And the medical examiner's office shared this determination with the public as well. And according to court documents, the Philadelphia Police Department immediately pushed back against the ruling. They then asked Dr. Osborne to change the manner of death to pending while they continued their investigation. The following day, homicide detectives were brought into the case and they searched the apartment for the first time. One of the only items they collected as evidence was Ellen's engagement ring, which was a family heirloom. They didn't obtain Ellen's phone or her laptops, and that's because they weren't there. Detectives also reviewed surveillance footage, key fob data, and phone records to piece together a timeline of Ellen and Sam's movements for that day. Let's break that down, starting with after they both got home for the snow day. We know that while Ellen was grading papers, she was also texting with a friend, and the conversation seemed completely normal. In fact, at 2:33 p.m., Ellen called a restaurant and made a dinner reservation with that same friend, and this was the last call she ever made. So again, if we go back to suicide real quick, this is someone who's going to be taking their own life in just a couple hours, and yet they're making dinner reservations with a friend. Has it happened before? Yes, it has, but highly unlikely. Not something you often see associated with a suicide. Then Ellen continued texting with that same friend. And as the conversation came to an end, she talked about work, saying she was just struggling to get the grades entered and that she wanted to scream. At 3:47 p.m., her friend responded, saying that she would help her grade that evening if Ellen scanned the papers and sent them over, but Ellen never responded, and she didn't use her phone again after that. Surveillance footage and key card records revealed that at 4:51 p.m., Sam entered the building's gym. He left at 5:30 p.m., and 1 minute later, he was seen getting on the lobby elevator while reading the mail. Unfortunately, there were no cameras on the sixth floor, so it's unclear exactly what all happened when Sam was up there, and isn't that always the way of it, right? Another point of contention here where we don't have video evidence that could help support or disprove certain reports of what happened. And I do know that this is a point of contention for a lot of people who've studied this case. I was watching some videos from Gavin Fishy as an extensive series on this, and he was asked in one of his videos if he felt like the latch could be locked from the outside. And he responded by saying, well, that's not the right question. The question should be, was it locked at all? And that is something that we don't know. We only have Sam's account of what happened. Now, there are some witnesses, especially from this new 32-page report, that's suggest there was something behind the door, that there was some resistance where the door couldn't be opened. And we're going to get into that. I'm trying to go in chronological order here, but we are going to address it. But yeah, this is something where if we had video footage from that floor, it would give us even more information to determine what happened that evening. But we don't have it. How often do we get this, right? In all these cases where if we just had one more camera, maybe I wouldn't be sitting here right now. Who knows? According to court documents, from 5:32 p.m. to 5:54 p.m., Sam sent multiple text messages to Ellen. As time went on, they grew more and more tense. He wrote things like, quote, I'm getting pissed. You better have an excuse. What the fuck? Ah, and you have no idea. What you want to take from this? I don't know. It could be just a guy who's frustrated and maybe he's someone who has a big bark but no bite. On the other hand, things like you better have an excuse, you have no idea. I don't know what to take from that. It could be something completely innocent, but the comments like you better have an excuse or you have no idea. What do you mean by you have no idea? How would that sentence end? What else would be added to it? Is you have no idea how pissed I am, or you have no idea what I'm going to do when I get inside? Big difference, right? And so that's some concern there, that he's that frustrated and that he's making those comments where if she's not answering him, what does he hope to accomplish in that moment other than threatening her? So yeah, could be just a guy who's mad. Listen, I'll be the first to admit I've had plenty of arguments with my significant other and I'm sure you have as well. And it's not uncommon to be upset with your partner and say some things you don't mean, but we wouldn't be doing our job if we didn't acknowledge it. But I do want everyone to pause the episode, pause the video right now. Man or woman, single or married or in a situationship, whatever it might be. What do you think of these quotes? What do you think of these text messages? Is it a nothing burger, or do you think it's a look into maybe the behavior and the verbiage that Sam used with Ellen on a consistent basis? Now, if that's the case, if this is truly how he felt, now it poses another question for you. Because if he's saying these things and he truly means it and he's threatening her, and this is something he often does, if he already knows that she's dead behind that door, is this what he's going to say? Or is he going to say it to throw law enforcement off the scent, right? You see how I'm doing that? You could take it both ways. Is this all staged? Or is this his true feelings? Weigh in, let me know what you think. You can go one way or the other. You're not wrong, regardless of how you interpret it. So at 6:10 p.m., Sam was seen leaving the lobby elevator and walking toward the concierge desk. The concierge told police that Sam said he was locked out of his apartment and appeared agitated and sweaty. When the concierge offered to unlock the door with the master key, Sam declined, saying it was locked from the inside. The concierge told him to return to the sixth floor and call out to Ellen while they tried calling from the front desk. So Sam went back to the elevator and presumably back upstairs while the concierge called Ellen's cell phone twice, but she didn't answer. By 6:31 p.m., Sam was back in the lobby, and the concierge said he looked even more agitated than before. When he was told there was no way to open the latch from the outside, Sam asked to speak with maintenance. The concierge called the maintenance supervisor and handed the phone to Sam. After the call ended, Sam left the front desk again. At 6:33 p.m., Sam got back on the elevator, and before the minute was over, he called 911 and reported that he had broke down the door and found Ellen on the kitchen floor. By the way, I know there is much more to that timeline, but if you're familiar with this case, then you also know that that information wasn't released until years later. So I'm going to cover that in the next episode. Just bear with me, especially for anybody in the comments on YouTube. If you're sitting there saying, he's missing this, he's not covering this, trust me, I'm going to try to get to as much as I can. I'm trying to do it in chronological order. I'm not trying to interrupt the storyline every 2 minutes. There are a couple things already that I haven't pointed out yet. For example, I'll give you a little bit of something. In this new recent report, it's in there that the first call from Sam happened at 5:24 p.m., which was before he would have left the gym. So did he call Ellen when he got up to the room, the apartment, and realized the door was locked? Or did he start calling her before he left the gym? This is just one small thing that came out many years later. So I'm going to get to it. We're going to talk about it all. I'm just trying to get through the storyline. So stick with me on this. If you've been with me for a long time, then you know I'm going to try to hit every point. We still have more in this episode. Let's take a break and we'll keep going on with the story. Shopping, planning, and cooking food really can be simple and stress-free. Imagine having your weekly shopping cart filled for you and your meals for the week decided on. Taking all the work off my plate is why I love Hungry Root. Hungry Root takes the stress out of mealtime by filling your cart with personalized picks and planning your week of meals, getting smarter with every order. With over 15,000 recipes to choose from each week, many of them ready in just 15 minutes or less, and a wide grocery selection including smoothies, sweets, kid snacks, salad kits, ready-to-eat meals, and supplements, it's easy to find options that fit your whole family's taste and nutrition goals. Hungry Root helps you eat well and reach your diet or health goals, whether that's gluten-free, dairy-free, high-protein, focused on gut health, or anything else. Just take a quick quiz, and their smart cart technology recommends groceries, recipes, and supplements tailored to your taste and needs. It's like having your own personal shopper and chef all in one, so you can spend less time planning and more time doing what you love. I just recently had their grass-fed beef ribeye steak. I also had a sweet potato, a microwavable sweet potato. I don't know if this is a new concept. Maybe I'm just behind on this one, but it came in like this microwave-safe saran wrap. You put it in the microwave for a few minutes, it pops out, and it tastes like it was baked in the oven. It was absolutely delicious. Again, don't make fun of me. I had never seen that before. Absolutely loved it. I also tried their buffalo chicken jerky stick, which was delicious. And of course, I had my go-to, the sun butter and jam dipper. If you haven't tried those yet, you have to. And Hungry Root holds all of its food to high standards, screening out over 200 additives, including high fructose corn syrup, artificial sweeteners, and preservatives. They source only high-quality meat and seafood with no hormones or antibiotics, offer organic produce and non-GMO options, and carry trusted healthy brands like Oatly, Vital Farms, Ithaca Hummus, Harmless Harvest, and many more. So take advantage of this exclusive offer. For a limited time, you can get 40% off your first box, plus you can get a free item in every box for life. All you have to do is go to hungryroot.com/detective and use my code DETECTIVE. That's hungryroot.com/detective, code DETECTIVE, to get 40% off your first box and a free item of your choice for life. One more time, that's hungryroot.com/detective, code DETECTIVE. Okay, we're back. And before the break, I was just mentioning, I'm trying to stay in chronological order here, but I'm going to be referencing some of the stuff in this new medical examiner's report from Lindsay Simon. And here's a moment right here. I'm going to get to something. So in addition to checking the key fob data, looking at surveillance footage, looking at cell phone records, Detectives also spoke with the neighbors, and according to the new medical examiner's report from Lindsay Simon, one neighbor told the police that they arrived home between 5:30 and 5:45 p.m., and when they did, they saw Sam in the hallway knocking on his apartment door, asking to be let in. And this neighbor went on to say that when they went inside their apartment, they could still hear Sam knocking on his door. So about 15 minutes later, they stepped back into the hallway and suggested that Sam ask the front desk for a master key. Sam explained that the door was latched from the inside, and he pushed on it to show what he meant. Now, the neighbor couldn't see the latch, but they did say it made a noise and it was, quote, clear it was latched. After that point, the neighbor went back into their apartment. On January 29th, detectives interviewed three of Ellen's friends. All of them described her as being stressed, anxious, or depressed about her job as a teacher. However, she was not suicidal, according to them. None of the friends expressed any concern about Sam. One described their relationship as, quote, wonderful. Another said Ellen, quote, loved her fiancé to pieces. The third claimed that Sam was, quote, a great guy. That same day, detectives collected Ellen's cell phone, her work and personal laptops, and Sam's laptop from his family. Ellen's work computer was searched, and detectives learned its last activity was 4:46 p.m. Ellen's personal laptop was sent to the FBI for analysis, and according to court documents, there was nothing on the device indicating suicide. Despite that, police stated publicly that they were, quote, leaning towards suicide and would continue looking into Ellen's recent struggles with her mental health. Behind the scenes, they spoke to Dr. Osborne about their concerns, but he refused to change the manner of death and continued to rule Ellen's case as a homicide. Because of that discrepancy, it was suggested that an independent neuropathologist review that section of Ellen's spine to determine whether the neck wounds would have paralyzed her, making it impossible for her to inflict the final stab wound to her chest. According to authorities, and this wording is very important, so listen to what I'm about to say here. Neuropathologist Dr. Lucy Rourke Adams found that Ellen's spinal cord sheath had been damaged, but the cord itself was intact, meaning this injury could have caused Ellen's body to go numb, allowing her to continue stabbing without feeling pain. And that conclusion reopened the possibility that this was in fact a suicide, but that's not where the story with Dr. Rourke Adams ends, because there are some discrepancies, which is why I told you to focus on the words, because remember, these were conveyed to us by authorities, not Dr. Rourke Adams herself, which is very important. On February 6th, Sam spoke to detectives again, and according to the newly released medical examiner's report, he elaborated on the statement that he had given the night of Ellen's death, and Sam repeated the same account of the day leading up to finding her, with a few added details. He told detectives that Ellen had been, quote, very stressed about school that day, specifically because grades were due. He said she had tried to work that afternoon, but seemed unable to concentrate. Sam claimed he consoled Ellen, and then he went to the gym. He said Ellen typically only latched the door shut when she went to sleep or when he was traveling, and that she didn't usually lock it when he went to the gym. Sam then explained that he didn't force entry into the apartment sooner because he thought Ellen might have been in the shower, wearing headphones, or even taking a nap. Sam was also asked for details about Ellen's state of mind leading up to January 26th. He denied knowing of any prior self-harm and said he hadn't had any serious concerns about Ellen's mental health before her death. He also denied any domestic violence in their relationship. Sam stated that Ellen had lost her confidence in her teaching abilities at the start of the 2010 school year and that her job had started to, quote, take over her life. And I will say, speaking anecdotally, I think we've all had people in our lives who have a job that they hate and all they want to do is talk about it. Whether you go to lunch, whether you're just sitting on the couch watching TV, whether you're at a family event, if they have an opportunity to segue into how much they hate their job or how many struggles they're having with a particular colleague or a boss, they just can't seem to get over it. I know a lot of you have to have had experience that. And, you know, if they trust you and they feel like they can open up to you and they can vent to you and you're willing to listen, sometimes they can take advantage of that. And although you want to be a good friend or a good partner, it can become a lot where all they want to do is talk about that day or night. It consumes them. And so I get it. From that perspective, I can understand where she was going through a difficult time And it was something that even when she wasn't at work, that's all she could think about. I've been there. I'm sure many of you have been there. It's a normal thing. It happens. Does it lead us to kill ourselves? And we really got to think about this too, because we can't just skate over it, right? Everyone here has said that she was struggling with her teaching abilities at school. And on this particular day, she was grading papers and she was struggling to get them in on time. That's what they're all saying. And it's proven in the text messages. That was the big hang up here. Is that going to drive someone to kill themselves? Is that the trigger? Being late with a couple grades? And by the way, I'm not trying to diminish what teachers do. I couldn't do it. I got two kids and two is more than enough for me. But what I'm saying here is we have to believe that even though she had been struggling with the school year, it was the possible tardiness of a few grades that led her to stabbing herself 20 times. And I'm not trying to be sarcastic here. That's what we have to believe, is that it finally was too much for her. It finally got to her. The grades were the breaking point, even though a friend offered to help. And based on what Sam has told us, she would have been still alive at that point, unharmed. So all that being said, this is what drove her to this. I don't know, guys. I'm struggling to get there. And I think a lot of you are in the same boat. And that's why so many of you have asked me to cover this. Now I'm understanding why. And while Sam was talking to detectives about how school was taking over her life, he also explained that she started to avoid social events and she was making more excuses to stay home, usually citing work-related reasons. And what was fascinating to me is that he elaborated even further, saying that in January, when Ellen, quote, this is his words, started getting depressed, she reportedly asked Sam if he, quote, would still love her if she was crazy. And now, of course, according to Sam, he responded by saying, hey, listen, my love, quote, is unconditional. And at another point, Ellen told Sam that, quote, she just wanted to feel like her old self again. So these are all things that Sam is now elaborating on. He's painting more of a picture that she was depressed and anxious and really consumed by this, and even stating that she was crazy. Make what you want of it. I'm just reporting the facts to you. This is what Sam is telling detectives at a later date. And this is his words, right? We have no way to confirm that it's actually true. Ellen's no longer with us, so he's the only game in town. There's no person that we can corroborate his statements from. So that's the unfortunate thing here. It is convenient when you think about the possibility that he's involved some way, that he's painting a stronger picture as to why she would have killed herself. Now, there's also a possibility he's telling the truth, and it's just adding more context to the fact that Ellen killed herself. It's giving us more of an explanation as to why she may have done what she did and how she was feeling at the time when she did it. But again, I'm just going to go back to the whole premise of why she killed herself. School not being what she wanted to be, her job not being what she had hoped it would be, and the grades being due and her not having them in on time. Listen, this is a job. You can quit your job. You can go do something else. She knows this. Ellen knows this. Everybody knows this. So to think, even if she made these statements, that it would lead to this, it's still a big jump for me. Sorry. Even if his statements are true, I don't see the correlation of how we get from that to this. And I will say, after Sam gave his statement, which you can take it or leave it, he did voluntarily provide a DNA sample, and that was the end of the interaction. So he is being cooperative. I will say that. He's cooperative. He's speaking with law enforcement. He's providing anything they want. That is more than we can say for some other people. So law enforcement speaks with Sam. He gives the interview. He gives the DNA samples. And then 3 days later, on February 9th, detectives interviewed Ellen's coworkers. They said she had been very stressed about recent grading changes at the school, and she had talked about quitting, though Sam had urged her not to. Her coworkers went on to say that she had recently started treatment for stress and sleep issues, but she also told them that the medication was helping. And despite her anxiety, they described her as happy about the engagement and said she often spoke warmly about Sam. So now fast forward to February 18th, just 9 days after interviews with Ellen's coworkers, the Philadelphia Police Department declared that Ellen Greenberg's death had now been ruled a suicide. Detectives said they had no evidence pointing to another conclusion and were, quote, just letting things go where it went. But here's the thing. At that time, Dr. Osborne still had not changed his findings. In his eyes, Ellen's death was still a homicide. However, that ruling wouldn't last much longer because around 6 weeks later, Dr. Osborne reluctantly updated Ellen's death certificate, changing the manner of death from homicide to suicide. And one of the reasons for this change was Dr. Rourke Adams' findings, where she allegedly told authorities that Ellen still could have stabbed herself in the chest even after stabbing herself in the neck. But Josh and Sandy weren't convinced. They believed their daughter hadn't taken her own life, and they decided to launch their own investigation. And what they uncovered was astounding. First off, Sam's cousin, who is an attorney, arrived at the apartment 1 minute after the 911 call. Also, Sam's family had the apartment professionally cleaned even before Ellen's autopsy was complete. And Dr. Rourke Adams, the expert whose statement police used to justify their suicide ruling, she later said she never even examined Ellen's spinal sheath at all. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. But all of that and more, we'll have to wait for part two. And in addition to going over more facts in this case, because they were constantly unfolding over the years up until just a few days ago, I'm going to sit down for a conversation with pathologist Dr. Priya Banerjee, who is the former medical examiner here in Rhode Island. And she has strong opinions about this case. And a big reason, as I mentioned, why I decided to cover it was how convincing she was in her analysis of these injuries and what they indicate. And I'm going to let her tell you directly, but I will tell you, it got me to where I am right now. And that's why I'm covering it. And it's why I want her on the show. So we got a lot more to go over. This is different. It feels weird not giving you my perspective right now, but we got a whole nother episode to go, maybe even one more. Let me know what you guys think so far. If there's something that you feel I'm not going to cover and it needs to be covered and you want to weigh in down in the comments, please feel free to do so. I know there's a lot. I know there's more injuries we haven't talked about. I know there's some timestamp issues. I know there's some discrepancies in the reporting on what happened that evening, specifically from Sam. Did he have someone come upstairs? Did he not? I'm aware of all of it, but if there's something you really want to make sure that I hit, leave it down in the comments because I will be reading all of them because I want to get this right. I don't want to leave any stone unturned. I want to give it the attention and respect that it deserves, not only for Ellen, her family, but everyone involved. And I don't take it lightly that all of you have trusted me to cover this case. So many recommendations for you guys and suggestions that I cover this one, and that has not been lost on me, that you respect my opinion and you wanted me to put my stamp on it. And I don't take that responsibility lightly. So I promise you, I'm going to do my best. We have a lot more to cover. But until then, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you next week for part two.